Hello, and a warm welcome back to Braillecast, connecting the dots for Braillists everywhere. Coming up this time, we're finding out about Banzat and their Braille transcription course. Many countries have a Braille Authority, an organisation whose purpose it is to set Braille standards. But many Braille authorities do more than just standard setting. They also have a hand in promoting Braille and, in some cases, certifying Braille producers. In New Zealand, the Braille Authority is Banzat, and the chair is Maria Stevens. I had the opportunity to catch up with her recently to find out more about the organisation. I daren't say what Banzat stands for, so perhaps you could enlighten us. What does Banzat stand for?
It stands for Braille Authority of New Zealand, Aotearoa Trust.
And the significance of those last two words are that I guess that's the name for New Zealand in the traditional languages?
Yes.
And when was it established?
I can walk you back to 1992 when there were two separate groups, Braille Management Panel and the Braille Authority of New Zealand. Braille Management Panel was more to do with the teaching and kind of promotion of Braille. The Braille Authority of New Zealand was the standard setting model. But in August 2010, the two organisations joined together and became Banzat. And these two groups, I guess, or panels were set up by the Blind Foundation, now Blind Low Vision. But when we became Banzat, we became a trust in our own right. We've got our own deed and we have a funder. We try to get more funds as most groups do, but yeah, that is a difference.
And that's good because I guess the Blind Foundation, what's now Blind Low Vision NZ, is probably the principal, if not the only really Braille producer in New Zealand, as I understand it.
Yes, there is one producer and Blend, Blind Low Vision Education Network New Zealand. They produce now the educational arm of Braille and accessible formats. That was a change a couple of years ago. Before that, Blind Low Vision had the contract for the Ministry of Education work, but now there's two sort of separate arms of production. So BLV does the adult side, Blends does the education student side of things. And then we have another company, AI Comms. Two members run this company. They also provide Braille and audio.
And so who would you say are the members of Banzat?
We have five founding bodies. Blind Low Vision, they have two members on Banzat. Blends, Blind Low Vision Education Network New Zealand, also has two members. Kapo Māori, they have one member representative. Parents of Vision Impaired have one representative. And Blind Citizens New Zealand, an advocacy group, has one representative. And so those seven can and do co-opt or can co-opt five more members from their organisations, or we've just put out an expression of interest for people who wish to serve on Banzat. So that's gone out quite widely for obviously mainly people involved with the teaching, production, or reading of Braille.
Okay, so that's sort of your board of trustees, I suppose. And having it not just limited to those five founder members must be quite good, not only in terms of bringing in additional expertise, but also the way that you're advertising for those trustees must mean that a lot of those trustees would end up being Braille readers themselves.
Yes.
We've talked about Braille authorities a lot on this podcast before. We have the UK Association for Accessible Formats over here in the UK. We've talked about the Braille Authority of North America a little bit. The role of a Braille authority is to set standards, I guess, and to promote Braille. The main standard is Unified English Braille, presumably. So what does Banzat publish to support that?
So we have New Zealand guidelines for the rules of Unified English Braille. Mainly, we add in there the way that Māori Braille is treated in New Zealand. We work alongside the Roundtable, Information Access for People with Print Disabilities, where we go along to their meetings and we work with the Australian Braille Authority. So we follow the Roundtable guidelines as well and promote those here.
Yes, and the Roundtable include your guidelines as well, don't they, for things like you have a Duxbury template, I think. And I think the Roundtable Duxbury Manual also includes information about that template.
Yes. We used to have a Braille promotion role at Blind Low Vision. This role went around and promoted Braille to organisations. That was kind of driven from Blind Citizens New Zealand and taken on by BANZAC, but that role's been disestablished. But it just promoted Braille out there in the community for signage and hotels, all sorts of things. So BANZAC does a bit of that now.
Yes, and I saw on the website actually that there was a signage guide, I think, that you'd worked on. I'm not sure if BANZAC owns that or if BANZAC just contributed to it, but it looked like a very comprehensive guide on signage.
BANZAC developed that with Blind Low Vision and Blind Citizens New Zealand. About 2019, I think, is the last update. So it kind of needs a bit of a revamp, but that's what we send out to a lot of the companies that want to put Braille signage around, like when their toilets or lifts or and their, you know, menus, things like that.
And sort of going back to what you were saying about working with the Roundtable, one of the Roundtable's probably most famous publications over in the UK is the UEB Australian Training Manual. And that seems like a fairly comprehensive resource, but my understanding is that New Zealand doesn't format things in quite the same way as they do over in Australia. So do you have a sort of separate New Zealand version of that?
We do have a separate version of that. And one of the roles of BANZAC is standard setting and quality. And earlier this year, the manager of Accessible Format Services, or the manager that oversees that service, wanted New Zealand to follow the Australian guidelines. So he put a proposal to BANZAC, and it's things like the page numbers are in a different placement, the way they treat their headings is a little bit different to ours. So BANZAC said, oh look, we can't support this proposal. So that's kind of one of the things that we've done as well.
And if you wanted just sort of a quick reference to New Zealand formatting, I think it's sort of fairly similar to the Banner Braille Formats Guide, but I think there is a basic introduction to formatting as well that BANZAC have come up with.
Yes, we used to follow the English way back in the early days, then we changed to the American and the Nemeth code, and now we're with UEB.
And you're one of the first countries actually to adopt UEB, which is very exciting. How's that going?
It's fine, because we're a small country. We went around to a lot of the main centres and talked to blind Braille readers, teachers, and showed them the differences for the code we used to use and the new UEB code. So we adopted in 2005. There was some training done 2006, half of 2007, mainly for producers and resource teachers' vision. And then we started producing at the end of 2007, 2008. And the only thing with the transition we found was the students who were at their, say, I don't know, year 12, year 13, we didn't transition them because they were already nearly at the end of their schooling before, you know, with the maths and the science. So that was a gradual transition. Everything else was fine.
And now it's just embedded, isn't it? I mean, there's still a bit of unrest over in the UK, but when I was over there in New Zealand, my perception was that New Zealand had just accepted it.
Yeah, we have actually. And even I know in the States, as you probably know, there's still a lot of division between Nemeth and UEB.
But New Zealand's just gone completely over to the UEB maths code. And in fact, New Zealand was responsible, I think, for writing, not entirely responsible, but I think it was one of the New Zealand people in alternative formats at the time that was responsible for editing the first guidelines for technical material.
Yes, it was. Janet Reynolds, when she was manager and she was a maths teacher at Blind Low Vision, she, with others' help, was driving that manual.
Speaking of teachers, I guess BANZAC has representation from resource teachers of vision, so what we would call QTVIs or TVIs, teachers of the visually impaired, over here. What about the education system in general? There'll be exam boards that will want to know how to transcribe their exam papers and things like that. And I imagine a lot of the exam papers will be transcribed by Blends or Blind Low Vision. But does BANZAC have any interaction with sort of the more mainstream teachers, the more mainstream stakeholders, exam boards, government, any of that sort of thing?
No. BLV does all the exam papers, NZQA or exam papers for the students, and they have an agreement. It's a separate agreement from the production of the of the novels and things for adults, but they do the exam papers and we don't have anything to do with that. It blends. I used to work at Blind Low Vision for quite some years. So we have an agreement that we sign and everyone signs confidentiality, and it's all very tight. The regulations around how the exams are sent to us and how we do them and how they're sent is very, got very strict rules for it. But as far as I know, BANZAT doesn't have anything to do with the exam bodies.
No, okay. So BANZAT sets the standards that Blind Low Vision follow, and then Blind Low Vision have a business agreement to actually produce the exams.
Yes.
That takes us nicely onto accreditation then. There's Blind Low Vision, there's BLENZ, and they follow BANZAT standards, but presumably they would like to be able to demonstrate that they are following BANZAT standards. And having had a quick look, there are two main accreditations that you run. Do you want to just talk us through those? Perhaps start with the Trans-Tasman and explain to people what that is.
The Trans-Tasman Certificate of Proficiency in UEB is an exam set by Australia and New Zealand. This year it's New Zealand's turn. It has three parts. Part A is print to braille, and it has a sample of text, like something out of a book, a recipe and a poem, which have to be translated into braille. Part B is braille that people have to translate back into print, and it will have 10 questions with maths and science and numbers, all sorts of things that people should know. And part C is a proofreading test where they've given a piece of braille and they have to find 10 or more errors. We have to make sure there's 10, but sometimes there's 11, sometimes there's 12. So that's how the Trans-Tasman works. And Australia takes a turn, then we take a turn.
And when you say Australia takes a turn and you take a turn, that's taking a turn and actually setting the content of the exam. So New Zealand and Australia still mark their own candidates each year.
Yes, because difference in formatting, and then the marking up files, there's four braille readers. So Australia will mark them up the way that they want to, and we'll mark them up for the braille reader the way we do. Doing it in grade one braille or uncontracted braille, and you just put like para at the beginning or centered heading, or see there's codes. And so the braille is just a straight piece of braille all at the margin with instructions for centered headings or cell five headings or a list. So that's kind of how we mark them up, so the braille reader will know.
Sure. So they just get a grade one completely just unformatted other than these markers, and then they're expected to copy from the grade one into grade two and put in all the formatting.
Yes.
And what do they use to do that? Do they use a Perkins or Perky Duck or either of them, or how does that work?
So they can use a Perkins or they can use Perky Duck. And there is a form that people sign, so they haven't cheated or checked with anyone else about it.
Yeah, of course, because you don't go to the BANZAT office or the Blind Low Vision office or the BLENZ office, you know, you just do it in your own workplace, I guess.
Well, yeah. You are, yeah. You've got a 7-day window to sit it, and then you can either send hard copy back or you can send a BRF file or in a Word doc, and we can print them and emboss them here.
And there are sighted people that do this exam as well. So for them, presumably, the print to braille would literally be a piece of print. They wouldn't get the grade one marked up braille. They would just get print.
Yep.
So who can sit the Trans-Tasman?
Anyone can sit it, so long as they've worked their way through our New Zealand manual. And obviously there's some training resources online from Australia. When I'm marking the exams, I mark from braille to braille and I'll count 20 errors. And if we get to the 20 errors, then I won't mark anymore. It's a 70% pass mark. And if folk have made 20 errors in the first piece, it's pretty unlikely that they're going to pass. But anybody in New Zealand can sit it. We have taken some people from Fiji or Samoa to sit in as well.
And they don't just have to be producers. That was really kind of the thrust of that question, was you could just be a blind person that just wants to demonstrate that you know braille, or you've done all this braille all the way through school and you've got nothing to show for it. So you just sit the Trans-Tasman just as a way of showing all of that work that you've put in.
Yes. And Chantal's running a class for six blind people who want to be producers. They will have to have had or going to sit the braille proficiency exam. And most of them have. A couple are still working on it, but it's encouraging more braille readers and blind people to become producers because there is the work there.
And I suppose that leads us on to our second accreditation. I don't know how many people have actually sat this particular accreditation, but I understand that there is a second exam or a second accreditation program that BANZAT offers for people that want to become producers of Braille, and particularly producers of Braille using, you know, embossers and translation software and that sort of thing.
There's only one company at the moment, that's AI Comms. That's the two-member run company. And they pay us a fee for BANZAT every year because they have gone through and they can produce Braille. And they do a lot of government work or member-driven work, like Blind Citizens New Zealand will send them work to do in Braille or audio.
Sure, but they don't have to be the only one. I mean, if somebody else wanted to start a transcription company in New Zealand, they could also apply for that accreditation if they wanted to.
Yes, they definitely can.
And is that a sort of, you sit an exam once and then that's it? Or do you have to be periodically assessed to make sure that the accreditation is still up to date and still worthy of being accredited?
Because we haven't had that many, we haven't had a lot of people wanting to do that. Once you've set it, that's it. But there's a lot of Braille that comes out that Braille readers get. And when the Braille is sent out from AI Comms, there's always a little paragraph in there that says, if you have any feedback or you have any concerns about the Braille, please contact the producer, which I must tell you, Braille people, particularly some of us do, about if we found an error. So although we don't have that marking, you know, you have to sit it every year, the Braille that people put out, that they put out anyway, is well critiqued.
Yes, and I mean, I think if there was a serious problem, you know, if their Braille suddenly went downhill, then perhaps BANZAT could intervene and say, actually, we're not going to accept your fees this year because we've had too many complaints.
Yeah.
But it's good that you've got it, even if not many people have got it, because it's something that I think a lot of countries lack. And so it's actually quite forward thinking to have come up with an accreditation program for computer produced Braille.
Thank you.
So you mentioned the role that BANZAT had in the past about promoting Braille. And we've talked a lot about standards and accreditation and anything else. And we've talked a bit about the transcription course. Are there any other projects, any other things, activities that BANZAT are involved in to really promote Braille and Braille quality and to train people, to teach people, anything like that at all?
We have a competition for students that's run through Blends every year for Braille reading students. This year they're talking about Lego and writing a story in Braille about the Lego bricks in Braille. We had a poetry competition. We had a storytelling competition for any students, because a lot of our students are mainstream, like many countries. So the Art Resource Teachers Vision promote this course, and we had about 51. So we get quite a good uptake on the course, and they get gift prizes if, you know, for the winners. Or so it just promotes Braille in that way. Sometimes people aren't as wanting to promote Braille as other electronic devices that the students have. So this is a good way for the RTVs and the students to think, oh, hey, Braille is, you know, is still alive and people still use it.
I'd forgotten about that. I heard about this might be the program, or it might be a similar program, where children would get together with almost Braille mentors. They get adult Braille readers to work with children and to sort of demonstrate what was possible through Braille.
Yes, and that's one of the ones that we've done as well. We've had a Zoom meeting where a few adults have read Braille and talked about their Braille journeys. Some went later blind later in life and learnt Braille. Some learnt it, you know, from when they first went to school.
And the nature of being completely independent and being a trust and being completely focused on Braille means, I suppose, that if there was an idea that one of the trustees put forward, obviously there'd be a need to get money for it, but if you could get the money and you could get the manpower, then it sounds like you would entertain the idea if you thought it had legs.
Yes. And we get a lot of inquiries about the signage, how people want to put signage around, especially new buildings. There's a big push for Braille on buildings and things around New Zealand. So although they've got building standards, we get some inquiries from people who are looking at putting Braille signage in their buildings, which is good.
And there was a thing at one point, I don't know if it's still a legal requirement, but there was a lot of campaigning done to get Braille inside taxi cabs, which I thought was very exciting.
Yes, well, the I think some of the taxi companies, but not all, have taken that up. So they have just the contact, like in the taxis, they have people, the taxi driver's name and their taxi number. We don't, you don't see that. So it's on the left front door of the taxi, on the passenger side.
Well, Maria, it's been great to hear more about the work of Banzat. Thank you very much for coming on the programme, and perhaps we'll hear from you again soon.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Maria Stevens, Chair of the Braille Authority of New Zealand, Aotearoa Trust. And if you'd like to find out more, you can visit their website at www.banzat.org.nz. Now, a Braillecast episode about New Zealand would not be complete without a conversation with our resident New Zealander, Chantelle Griffiths. Many listeners will know Chantelle as the moderator of most of our Braillists masterclasses. She's also presented a couple of masterclasses of her own. She's very involved in our Braille for Beginners course, and she came to us via the Tactile and Technology Literacy Centre, or TLC, and we'll be finding out more about that in a future episode of this podcast. But she also wears many other Braille hats, and there's one Braille hat in particular that I'd like to talk to her about today. So, Chantelle, welcome back to Braillecast.
I'm Matthew. Thank you for having me.
I've talked about what you get up to for the Braillists. Interestingly, we don't really know a great deal about you beyond that. So perhaps now's as good a time as any to fill us in about your background and sort of how you came to be where you are in Braille today.
So I started off as a Braille proofreader. That was my first introduction to the world of Braille after school. So I did proofreading literary Braille, but my speciality was music Braille proofreading. After that, I became an adaptive technology instructor. So here in New Zealand, I was showing people how to use JAWS and various screen readers, magnification, and also Braille devices. And during my time in Braille proofreading, I also learned how to do a bit of transcription, which meant that I got a really good insight into not only the proofing side of Braille, but also the creation of Braille. And that was really fascinating to me. After that, I became a Braille instructor. And so I've dipped in and out of both Braille teaching and also transcription over the years.
Awesome. And just as an aside, you have a really cool word for assistive technology instruction over there. You call it ACATS. Do you want to just explain what ACATS is?
Yeah, ACATS is kind of a generic term. It comes from our primary blindness organization, Blind Low Vision NZ, and it stands for Adaptive or Assistive Communications and Technology Services. So colloquially, it's just known as ACATS, and the people that do the technology and Braille instruction are known as ACATS.
Now, one of the other roles that you have in Braille in New Zealand is as a trustee of Banzat. And Banzat has a number of projects that it's involved in. And there's one project in particular that I'd really like to focus the rest of this interview on. And that is a Braille transcription course. And I was really excited when you first told me about this Braille transcription course, because I don't know of any Braille transcription course in the UK. I know of Braille transcription courses in the US. They're distance learning and they're very intense, and you do come away with a qualification, but it just seems very unfriendly. And your course sounded like it was really actually going to be quite different. So perhaps we could start off, if you just give us an overview of what that transcription course is all about.
One of the things here in New Zealand is that we're a small place and we don't really have a lot of Braille transcription knowledge outside of our main blindness organisations. So we've got Blind Low Vision NZ and we've got BLENZ, which is the Blind Low Vision Education Network of New Zealand. One of the things that we found is that the only way to learn Braille transcription here is to belong to one of those organisations. And in fact, in New Zealand, there are really only one or two people who are blind doing Braille transcription actively. So one of the things that Banzat thought was really good to do is to increase that knowledge within our community. So we got funding to run a Braille transcription course for vision impaired touch readers of Braille to learn some of these transcription skills that they otherwise wouldn't be able to learn.
Yeah, that's very cool. So I guess there's an element of upskilling blind and partially sighted people, you know, upskilling touch readers of Braille. I guess, is there possibly also an element of introducing some competition? You know, perhaps it feels like if the foundation is the only organization that's doing Braille, that they've got a monopoly and that monopoly may not be entirely healthy.
Yes, I think the main focus of the course is on the upskilling of blind and vision impaired people, but that's definitely an aspect that we considered as well.
So I guess a while ago, you'd have put out feelers to blind people, you'd have told them that this course was happening, you'd have put out an application form, probably some sort of application process. How did you decide when the applications closed who you were going to accept? I mean, how many places were there for a start? And then how did you decide how to fill them?
We had places for up to 6 participants. We knew that. That was a hard and fast stop. So when we put out the application form, we were very specific about the skills and experience each participant should have as a prerequisite before they applied. We were then able to drill down and figure out participants from those people. So, for example, some of the criteria were that you had to be a touch reader of Braille, you had to use a screen reader, you had to be familiar enough with your screen reader to operate in an intermediate or advanced level of word skills, and you also had to understand Braille, so how a Braille document felt, and then how to translate that into an electronic format, and vice versa. Preferably, you also had to have either done our local Braille qualification, which is the Trans-Tasman Certificate of Proficiency in Unified English Braille, or you had to have a high interest in obtaining that qualification.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought up the Trans-Tasman Certificate, because I was going to ask you about that. Some people would say there is a Trans-Tasman Certificate out there already. From what I've seen, it's fairly comprehensive. It assesses your knowledge of the Braille code. It assesses your knowledge of Braille formatting. So if they've already got the Trans-Tasman certificate, why do they need to take your course as well?
So you're right. It teaches all of the Braille-related knowledge about the code, about the formatting, about how to apply it in a New Zealand context. But what they don't have is how to actually produce the Braille from that. So you don't get the knowledge of how to use Braille transcription software, nor do you get the knowledge of how to format things like a Word document so that it translates well in the transcription software, or how to convert information from one format to another in order to get it into the transcription software in the first place.
No, and I guess the other thing that it doesn't talk about is how to set up a business. And I understand that that was actually something else that you focused on in the transcription course, was not just transcribing itself, but actually how to make money out of transcription.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a really unique aspect of the course, because we didn't just want people to learn how to transcribe Braille and then not have a pathway for being able to use those skills. So one of the huge aspects of the course is the small business aspect. So that means, how do you set up a small business? What's involved? What equipment do you need? How do you go about getting funding for that equipment? What avenues are available to you as a blind or vision impaired person for transcribing once you get up and running? What other pathways are available in the Braille world for using your skills? What can you do with it? Who can you approach? How do you get clients? All those kinds of things that are involved in running a small business, we have also included in the course.
So you've got a comprehensive plan of what you're going to cover in the course. You've got your 6 participants, you've whittled them down, and now you've got to teach them. So what form does that take?
First of all, a really important aspect of the course was that they wanted a vision impaired transcriber to teach the course. That was a huge aspect of it. In terms of the course itself, how it runs is we actually started off with an in-person workshop that went for 2.5 days. So the first day was all about setting up the technology, making sure that worked. And then after that, we spent the remaining 2 days going over the fundamentals of Braille transcription in terms of making sure that you had the information that you needed in the correct format, as in like a Word document, that you could then format that document correctly so that it would translate, and then turn that formatted document into a Braille document.
So that must have been pretty involved, setting up even the face-to-face side of that in terms of access to equipment, in terms of access to a location, in terms of having people around to support. Starting off with the equipment, I mean, were people expected to provide their own laptop and their own screen reader and their own Duxbury and their own embosser? Or how far did you go and how far did you take that?
It's a great question. As part of the application process, we said that if people had their own laptops and screen readers, that would be a preference because we didn't have the facilities or the support to be able to provide people with laptops or computers to use during the course. But one of the things that we were able to provide were free Duxbury licenses for all the participants. So Duxbury being the primary transcription program that many places use. They need to be able to get their own embossers or any other sort of braille production equipment. But many people were also able to bring their braille displays with them. So that made sure that they had that access to the braille. They could feel what was going on as they were transcribing the documents. They were able to access the electronic braille side of it as well.
Sure. So at the face-to-face weekend, you were really concentrating on the transcription element. There was no actual real live embossing going on.
Not for them. For us, there was the occasional producing documents behind the scenes. And one of the things that we did do is that we were able to take people's transcription. So they got to transcribe a number of different documents. So they did everything from like a simple letter to some tables to some recipes. And they got to choose a document that they wanted to then see in hard copy. So we were then able to take those documents that they had chosen and emboss them for each participant so that they had something to look at and something to take home with them as a tangible sort of hard copy result of what they'd done. Other than that, we didn't get to cover much in terms of the hardware side of things because of the transcription side being quite intense.
And in addition to giving them tangible hard copies of things that they transcribed, there were some really impressive hard copy resources that you gave out for them to follow. There was a workbook, and I think there might have been some electronic documents to go along with that workbook. Do you want to just tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, that was really exciting for us to prepare, actually. We decided throughout the course that in order for participants to get the best possible experience and also to have the most comprehensive resource that they could look back on, that we should provide resources in a number of different formats so that no matter what they were doing, whether they felt more comfortable using their computers and their electronic resources, or whether they were much more comfortable reading from hard copy, they had access to the resources in a way that worked for them. So we provided a hard copy workbook, and that contained all of the documents that we planned to work on. We kind of made it reasonably self-paced, so it wasn't like we went through and said, so for the first couple of hours, we're going to work on this document and then we're going to work on that document, because we were very aware that the people who came into the course may be at different levels in terms of their tech understanding and their tech experience with things like Word. So we didn't want to box people in by having a set time to do each task. So we provided each document in hard copy and electronic format so that they could feel the document, they could read the document unformatted. They could then read a copy with the instructions. So we wrote down, this needs to be a heading level one, this needs to be a paragraph, this needs to be a list. And they could read that. And then they could also feel and read the formatted version. So we had everything available in Word. We also had examples of those exact same documents in Duxbury format so that they could just open it up directly in Duxbury and look at things like the different elements of the transcription process. So they could see the text just as it was. They could see the codes that helped to format the text. And then they could see where we would go to emboss the document, things like page layout, all those types of things that you would normally see as a transcriber that you would normally encounter and do. They had an opportunity to do without necessarily having to format the entire thing themselves from scratch. So we really wanted to make sure that they had the most comprehensive resource available. And actually having everything done like that has proven really successful because as we've progressed through the course, they've been able to look back at those resources and ask questions.
And those resources would have had to have been written in a very skillful way because presumably you weren't able to specify on the criteria for the course what screen reader the participants were supposed to be using.
No, and we didn't want to. It was one of those things that we knew that there might be people who have all the other skills, but they don't necessarily have access to JAWS. We had a couple of NVDA participants as well. Most people did already have access to JAWS, but we didn't want that to be a barrier. So we made sure that we wrote the resources, the keystrokes. We had a very comprehensive list of keystrokes and screen reader and transcription related concepts in the back of the resources. And we tried our best to make sure that you could interpret them no matter which screen reader you were running. But we were also very clear that we didn't have as much experience with transcription with NVDA, and the participants who were using NVDA were really understanding of that. And in fact, they were able to provide some feedback to us as we went along that we didn't know. And we were then able to incorporate that into the course and be aware of that.
Running a face-to-face event is not easy. If you're just one teacher teaching six people face-to-face and they're all blind and they're all not wearing headphones because you need to be able to hear what their computers are saying, I mean, this could potentially be chaos. And this is before you get to food and accommodation and all of that sort of thing. So what was going on in the background? What help did you have? Where did you have it? Was it a particularly ideal location? How did all of that side of things work?
It was really fantastic. You know, we talked before about New Zealand being a small place and there not really being all that many places where we could hold something like that in the way that we would like. It was an immense undertaking, but the foundation, so Blind Low Vision NZ and Blends, both stepped up to the plate and really got behind the course. So we were able to hold it in one of the Blind Low Vision offices that had access to embossers and binders and things if we needed them. It had lots of hot desk space, so we were able to give everybody their own space. And we were able to use their facilities for the entire weekend. We had a lot of Banzat assistance in terms of making sure that we could get catering. There was a big team of volunteers that went on behind the scenes. We had two main transcribers, but there were some sighted volunteers as well who were also transcribers. So the team that we assembled to help on the day had that transcription knowledge, but also had the technology knowledge. So it meant that each participant got a lot of one-on-one time because we had four or five people in the room who knew what they were doing. We also had a trainee who knew enough about what she was doing to be able to help with the simple things. So it was a massive undertaking, but everybody really stepped up and got behind it all.
It sounds like there was a real sense of community around the face-to-face event. So it would seem a bit of a shame if you did a face-to-face event over a weekend and then said, right, you're off on your own now. It was nice to see you. Good luck in your business. So what is happening now to support the people who've been on that face-to-face weekend?
One of the aspects of the course that we were really clear on, as I said earlier, was that there was a pathway for people. So as you can imagine, we can't cover all the transcription aspects, all the technology related aspects, and all the business aspects in one weekend. So one of the things we did was we set up a series of online meetings over Zoom, and we designed those to be kind of masterclass meetings or extra sessions, depending on what people needed. So we've structured those such that the first couple of lessons were chances for people to get together and ask their questions about what we'd learned in the face-to-face aspect of the course. We also had someone come in and talk about running a small business separately. So we partnered with a really exceptional organization called The Generator, and they specialize in helping people who are just getting started with small business. And the rest of the sessions are basically designed to increase the knowledge and skill in areas that we weren't really able to cover. So we did a session on tables. We have covered some really interesting aspects, such as workflows for blind transcribers. We've got people coming in talking about their experience of running a small business and a small business as a transcriber. And we basically take the time to walk through some of those other aspects that take a little bit more time. So we try to run them once a month for an hour and a half, where everybody who can join comes on and has a chance to ask those questions. We may have some demonstrations. And at the end of the year, after all the courses are over, we are now planning, as a result of the feedback that we've had throughout the course, a second face-to-face weekend where we will touch specifically on the embossing, the binding, the labeling, all those logistics that we really do need to cover in person. People need to see those embosses in action. They need to feel the results of what happens when you do one procedure over another. And they all need to just get together and really celebrate their achievements as well.
Now, there'll be some people listening to this interview who'll be thinking, my goodness, this sounds absolutely incredible. It's a real shame that we can't internationalize this course. And I guess you've touched already on one of the reasons why you can't internationalize it, the face-to-face element, particularly when talking about embossing and binding and labeling and all of that sort of thing, is absolutely 100% important. I guess there might be some other reasons why it needs to be specific to New Zealand, possibly about running a business. You know, there might be business regulations as part of that, which are unique to New Zealand. And being a blind person in New Zealand is going to have different implications in terms of welfare and things to being a blind person in other parts of the world. Are there any differences, though, in terms of how New Zealand uses Braille and how New Zealand uses Duxbury and things like that that might make the course quite New Zealand specific?
So the main thing is that we have a Duxbury template that is specific for New Zealand that includes the Māori code. And although there aren't many changes to that, the one significant aspect of that is that we use a different Macron from the UEB Macron here in New Zealand to make the Māori code a lot easier to read. And we don't just use that Macron for Māori code, but we do also use it when transcribing other Pacific languages as well, such as Samoan and other languages that use the Macron in this part of the world.
And for those who are not familiar with New Zealand Braille, what is the New Zealand Macron?
We just use .456 before the letter.
Okay, so I guess that's to reduce the cell count and possibly make it a bit easier to read.
Yeah, it is, because we don't have a contracted version of Māori, and Māori Braille in particular does use a lot of macrons, as do the other Pacific languages that I mentioned before. So it just makes it a little bit easier to read, especially on things like signs, because here we have bilingual signs, and often the Māori code will be incorporated on those signs first. So we have to make sure that no matter people's Braille experience, they are able to read that. And we felt that using the 456 was an easy way to introduce them to Māori Braille and to make sure that it can fit in all the places that it needs to fit.
Circling back round to what we were talking about earlier on in the interview about course content and the things that you were going to teach and all of that sort of thing, is there anything while you were in the process of teaching the course that really kind of surprised you about it?
I think one of the things that I in particular was surprised by was just the diversity of knowledge between the participants in terms of their tech experience. So some people were really experienced with things like Word and the internet. In fact, most people were. But their knowledge of some of the things like being able to create headings and format paragraphs in the ways that they need to be formatted for nice Braille translation was really diverse. Some people struggled with that. Some people really flew through, but had interesting challenges with things like understanding how Duxbury worked with a screen reader. Some people hadn't had their Braille displays connected to their computers yet, so there was a lot of that kind of troubleshooting and figuring out just how best to go through that aspect. And we had included some information in the resources about how to format headings, for example, and structure a Word document so that it would translate. But we spent a lot of time making sure that people felt really comfortable working in Word at that level. And a lot of the participants fed back afterwards and said that that particular aspect of the training was really important for them, not just from a Braille perspective, but in their daily lives. So now they're structuring their documents in a way that makes them not just Braille ready, but more accessible for them as well.
Yeah, I mean, Word really is central to the whole transcription effort, isn't it, really? If you've got a good Word document, then you're good to go. And it's amazing. People don't really know what they don't know. So you end up having people who will self-certify as advanced Word users, and then you'll show them features of Word that they've never come across before.
Yeah, and that was what we did discover. We also discovered that there were areas of screen reader knowledge in general that we needed to work on just to make sure that people were comfortable, for example, getting information about what screen they were on, about the type of fonts and things that they were working with. It helped to kind of incorporate the word skills and the screen reader skills in one. And that's where I think that the team that we managed to assemble that had the technology experience as well as the transcription experience really helped to make it a very comprehensive experience for our participants.
Yes, because it's quite a specific set of screen reader skills that you need, isn't it? When we talk about screen reader skills, we're usually talking about, do you know how to browse a website? Do you know how to press H for the next heading? Do you know how to check the window title? Do you know how to read the current line? All of those sorts of fairly basic screen reader skills. When you're in transcription, it's a very different ballgame. We're talking about making sure that you don't miss a passage that was in bold, making sure that you don't have trailing white space at the end of a line, all of those sorts of very detailed, some would say very visual things, and some would say that blind people can't do it because it's too visual. How would you respond to that?
We absolutely can. I think it's a combination of learning how to listen really well to your screen reader, how to use your braille display if you have one connected so that you can read what's going on at the same time, and just being really aware of that attention to detail aspect. So if you've got a really good grounding in what's expected and what can happen if you don't check for things like that. And that's one of the things we did and why we produced the resources in the way that we did, is so that they knew what to look for. So the resources that we gave them didn't have things like white space, at least the formatted ones didn't. But we left in some mistakes in some of the resources so that they would learn even things like spell check to make sure that that's right. And so that they had a chance to really explore some of those finer details in terms of formatting, making sure that there aren't any blank lines, double checking, is there different font? Is there italics where there isn't supposed to be? So really just having practice going through some of those skills as well before they then got into Duxbury.
Yeah, and making sure that your screen reader doesn't announce single quotes as apostrophes, because I guess that was quite common. And I mean, this may be where JAWS has a slight edge, or at least making sure you understand exactly how your screen reader works. I imagine something like the speech and sounds manager in JAWS may have been a useful thing to cover, if not in the face-to-face weekend, then perhaps in a follow-up masterclass.
It's on the agenda for sure. It's one of those things actually that a lot of people don't necessarily think about unless you're doing that really detailed work with Word. I know that some of the feedback that we've had from teaching some of these skills from the participants is that their colleagues and people at work have commented on how neatly their documents are formatted. There's been some quite marked improvements there, and all the time I'm quite surprised, and pleasantly so, about the feedback that they are receiving from having really concentrated on those skills, trying to make it work as best they can. And the feedback from their sighted colleagues has been overwhelmingly positive.
You mentioned fairly early on in this interview that the course was funded. I don't know if you want to go into any more detail about how the course was funded, you know, who funded it. And was it fully funded, or did participants have to contribute something towards the cost of the course?
So when we want to do special projects, we figure out ways to get funding for those projects. And that's something that's been on the BANZAT agenda for a long time, because we recognise the need to upskill people here in New Zealand, and we wanted to make sure that we were able to do it and do it well. We had run one previous transcription course, but that was over 10 years ago. It was a long time ago. And a lot has changed in the Braille landscape since then, and also in the screen reader and Braille display landscape since then. And we recognized that it was something that we needed to revisit. So we applied for funding from our Lotteries Foundation, and participants didn't have to pay to attend. We also covered aspects like the flights and the accommodation. So the whole thing was fully funded.
My goodness, that's quite impressive. And I mean, I guess that will mean also that you're probably not going to be running this as an annual event. So do you have any sense of when and whether another course might run?
We would love to run it more regularly. That may take a different form over time. We will probably explore further avenues to support that at the end of the course, once we've had feedback from everyone and once we've had time to digest and perhaps implement that.
And just one final question before we wrap up this interview. If we think about the participants who are on the current transcription course and we look at where they'll be in a year's time, in 2 years' time, in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, what for you would be a successful outcome from this transcription course that you're running at the moment?
We've already had so much success in the course itself, everything from being able to use their technology more successfully, obviously have a small business of their own, to be confident in their ability to transcribe and maybe to even pass on some of the skills that they've learned, not just in the small business space, but in the transcription space to other people. Having more independent Braille producers in New Zealand is massive. And I think this is the first step in achieving that. And I think making sure that each producer has a really solid grounding in all these things and is producing the really high quality Braille that New Zealand's become accustomed to is a really big focus for BANZAT. And for me, just being able to see those skills that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily learn unless you're working in transcription or in a place that supported transcription already is massive and provides a lot of other opportunities, such as if people are studying, they can produce their own documents, they can format their own Braille, and they can do it well.
Our thanks to Chantelle Griffiths for coming onto the podcast and telling us more about the BANZAT Braille transcription course. And a reminder that if you'd like to find out more about BANZAT, you can visit its website at banzat.org.nz. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Braillecast, the official podcast of the Braillists Foundation. You can find more Braille-related content by subscribing to Braillecast, all one word, in your podcast client of choice. Or listening to Braillecast, connecting the dots for Braillists everywhere on your smart speaker. You can also find past episodes on our website at braillecast.com. If you have comments on the podcast or suggestions of topics or guests for future episodes, we'd love to hear from you. Please email help@braillists.org. You can also find the Braillists on Twitter at Braillists or on Facebook, facebook.com/Braillists Foundation. Finally, if you like what you've heard, spread the word. New listeners are always welcome. So if you know other people who are interested in Braille, please tell them where to find us. In the meantime, on behalf of everyone at the Braillists, thanks for listening and bye for now. The costs of producing this episode were defrayed by a resilience grant from the Social Impact Fund of the Vision Foundation and Fight for Sight. For more information, visit visionfoundation.org.uk.